friends, welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and the Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Chris Casso.
Hello.
Cole Hernaday.
Hi there.
Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
How is everybody this evening?
Wonderful.
Wonderful.
I'm fine. I'm fine now.
Yeah,
everything's fine. Yeah, we're all fine here.
Less punchy now.
How are you?
Just, you know, starting to mellow out.
We're on the reverse arc that we usually have.
We are reverse arc.
We'll be dead in next week.
We started in Punchy Town, and where do we go from here?
Well, the candy I ate before we started recording is worn off, so I'm getting the sleepies. Oh, I'll get it.
Well, hello, right.
That's my mom. Tell her I'll be home at 8.
Mom, I'm recording a podcast. Gosh.
Oh, man.
I told you about this. Did you buy me Doritos?
Well, Chris takes care of business. It's
No, I like the ranch flavor.
Okay, who went through and licked all the dust off the Doritos and put them back?
Well, maybe in your house.
Hey, let's talk about comics.
Okay.
Let's talk about creative burnout. This was actually a topic that was brought up a couple of weeks ago. And we thought at the time that it would be a good topic to tackle on its own. And let's prove ourselves right.
Okay.
Let's tackle this topic. Let's talk about creator burnout. Do you guys have any examples of who and why a creator had burnt out?
Bendis.
Bendis. Brian Michael
Bendis. I don't think he's ever burnt out.
Let's clarify burnout, because
it's subjective.
Yeah.
It's subjective.
Because to me, burnout is, you know, something as severe as getting to a writer's block situation where your creativity is just absolutely crispy, crittered, and there's nothing left there. But I also understand that it could also mean that, you know, your inspiration is shot. You know, you just absolutely run out of inspiration, and you're recycling old ideas, or you're just coasting.
See, and I took it as like people reading your material are like burnt out on you.
You're having a
burnout on like reading creators. Well, that's why I said Bendis, because everyone was just like, ugh, get off
Avengers
already.
I think they are mutually inclusive, though.
I mean,
why would you get burnt out on a writer other than the fact that you are tired of their same old song and dance formula?
It's
a different side of the coin.
Yeah.
See, and I just thought it was John Byrne's way of saying he's leaving a room. Burn out.
Oh.
Anyway, that was horrible. I'm sorry.
You did do that. You did do that, didn't you?
Usually I'm the one who makes the bad jokes.
Yeah, you know what? And I think it is now my responsibility to remind you that you did that for the next couple of weeks that you did that.
Fine.
You know, you did that, Chris. You did that.
Fine.
Yes. You have brought shame to the dojo.
All right. Do you have any characters or creators, Chris, whose work has suffered because either they just lost interest or because they were overbooked for projects?
Interesting. If you throw in the overbooked, that actually throws in like a whole lot. Because I think like actually Charles Soule is probably overbooked right now.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing a lot for Marvel. And I think his strengths lie more in sci-fi, but he's doing a little bit more superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
And but I also consider sometimes when people work for too many different companies that they get kind of spread thin.
Yeah.
So like Robert Venditti, who does a lot of work for DC, also does stuff for Valiant, and I notice his Valiant stuff feels stronger.
Mm.
Could be numerous reasons because of that. So I do like the idea of people kind of maybe pulling back, doing a little bit less. I always feel like Peter David is burnt out, but that might just be me because I feel he's repetitive in cycles.
Peter David is a tough one to take a look at because I gave up on him a long time ago. He used to be one of my favorite writers because even though he may have, you know, his books may have been pastiche or riddled with cliche and predictable stuff, there was always one or two really great jokes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he would have this moment of brilliance that would kind of, you know, poke its head out of the rest of the cardboard, you know. But I actually lost interest in his work a long time ago, which is unfortunate because, you know, there was a time where he was, you know, he was writing like 5 or 6 books a month, and I don't think that's an exaggeration. He had columns that he kept, like for Comics Buyer's Guide, and I read his column on a regular basis. He was really inspired. So I think actually he's a really good example of someone burning out. But, you know, you got to figure that people who make it big writing Illustrators are, you know, a whole other story because I think they burn out faster. But I always think in terms of writers now, you know, you dangle money in front of some of these folks and they're not going to turn it down and they're going to start writing 5 or 6 books a month. And that's a creative venture that I cannot imagine keeping ahead of.
Right.
And I remember back in the 90s and Gerard Jones was writing like 6 or 7 books. But, you know, he was also bringing home close to, you know, 100,000 a year or more. You know, he was making a lot of freaking money, but it was killing him.
An interesting variation of this is we seem to be focusing on a lot of like writers mm-hmm. burnout. Artists actually tend to get injured because they take too many projects. Mm-hmm. Like I remember Kupisek had a lot of problems, or not Kupisek, George Perez had a lot of problems.
Sure.
And I think they were with his wrist because the man draws so many detailed pieces of work that
got tendonitis or something.
Yeah, something like that. So I think that there are actually also cases of artists just being stretched way too thin because the schedule is much more grueling to them in mm-hmm. a number of ways, especially if you start shoving them into weekly or bi-weekly projects.
And in those cases, you'll see they'll cut corners on their own artwork and it won't be the mm-hmm. best work.
And I think that's one of the biggest tragedies is watching when an artist's artwork gets sloppy and lazy, because when I see that, I don't think that it's not a personal affront. I frequently look at that and go, that person is exhausted. Mm-hmm. You know, that person is creatively burning out, or, you know, be burning it at both ends.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I saw Amy Reeder's work on Batwoman, I thought they were like whipping her or something, because it just didn't even look like Amy Reeder's stuff that
like
I
what she does
previously.
For create her own stuff.
You know? Which she gives herself more time, I'm sure, for that. So
yeah. The I'm just trying to think of a few, like, this one's up in the air, like Joe Madureira. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you would consider that burnout or sellout, because he made a bunch of money and then he started learning that he could make more money by designing video game characters. Mm-hmm. But like, he didn't stick around long in the industry, and he basically created a very popular property, Battle Chasers, mm-hmm. and he like got all of 7 issues done, 8, 9 issues.
Right.
Only drew half of like the last issue, and then he went and started working on video game stuff. Mm-hmm. So part of that could be because it was just financially more beneficial for him.
Probably.
Part of it could also have been he grew out of comics and decided, like, I'm burnt out on this.
Well, that was the case with Dave Stevens. You know, Stevens never wanted to be a comic book artist. He wanted to sell movie properties, but he happened to deliver The Rocketeer, which was one of the most exquisitely drawn books of the 80s, and I would argue of all time, mm-hmm. but that was never what inspired him, and it took him forever to finish the first story arc. But it won, you know, all kinds of accolades from the top down awards. And, you know, then when we finally did get the Rocketeer movie, it was, you know, a fan success, but far from a critical success and far from box office success. But that's what he wanted to do. That's all he was interested in doing mm-hmm. with his talent. And you kind of look at what that guy did and you're like, you're a rock star, make more comic books.
He was meticulous. I actually remember reading too many stories of people who commissioned him work. They wouldn't get it till like years later because he would do a draft, not be happy, do a draft, not be happy, do a draft, not be happy. So it was so much of a kind of OCD perfectionist.
Sure.
That's one reason that there's not much of a body of work.
Well, and also in the case of The Rocketeer, it was a period piece, and he was that, you know, meticulous about the detailing of the costuming of the technology that mm-hmm. you know, if go look at The Rocketeer, if you've never looked at his original Rocketeer artwork, it was truly amazing, and is he is a great loss. We've lost a great artist when he died.
Have there been any titles that have just plain stopped mid story arc because a creator left?
Battle Chasers.
I mean, there's also like Nate Simpson's. Is Nate right?
Yeah, Nate Simpson.
He did Non-Player, and he had like all of life burn him out, and then he's been still keeping at the project, but it's like 4 or 5, maybe going on 6 years now, and he's only got 2 issues out.
Yeah.
And he's doing everything.
But he was in like a motorcycle accident.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's like life did everything.
Got a baby.
But there's, you know, Mark Schultz's Cenozoic Tales, you know. And again, another incredibly gifted artist, an exquisite talent, exquisite looking book. And when was the last time we had an issue of that? I think you looked, we talked about it on an earlier show.
Yeah.
But that's the one that sticks out in my mind.
And there's like Bernie Wrightson, who's getting up in years, who's been working on projects with Steve Niles that is just that
Frankenstein Alive, which I just think is such a brilliant book and one of the most inspired things that he's done. And I am I am terrified that he won't be able to survive to finish that book.
He probably won't. Don't it's been
his,
years.
His health is deteriorating. So. And
people have the same fear for George R.R. Martin.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Right. True. Yeah. Yeah.
What about when, scratch that. You talked about creators taking on multiple projects. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, and maybe you do or don't know this, what like an average annual salary is for like a mid-range author, because if they're taking on 5-6 books a month, is that because of greed or is that because they need that money to live?
There's no greed involved in it. That's the life of an artist. I mean, these people are struggling to put food on the table.
Yeah. Yeah. It's usually page rate based.
Yeah, so, I think with both writers and artists, it's page.
Yeah. Page I think there's based. Some contract stuff that basically ensures that you get a regular page rate. But
it depends on publisher too, because I've heard different things about different publishers and who treats people better, who treats creatives better, and who does not.
Yeah. I've heard Valiant's pretty good, but I think like some of the others, small press guys are kind of like IDW, because they also have to pay for their licenses and all that stuff. It's, you know, not terrible, but not great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because we hear so many stories of creators just dying penniless and alone, you know?
Yep. It's a lonely existence. And I think it's very similar to what it was back in the golden age. And, you know, I don't know that a lot has changed. It's a very isolated existence. I remember, I was driving to Emerald City Comic Con back when you could actually get a ticket to go to attend Emerald City Comic Con. Who was the guy that did Cry for Dawn?
Joseph Michael Linsner.
Linsner, and I was sitting in the van with him, and he's very much an introverted man, an incredibly gifted illustrator. I didn't care for his comic books, but that's beside the point.
Were you like a carpool van driver for creators?
No, really? I was actually a guest of an artist, and I was, I was loafing. Yes.
Okay.
That's beside the point, Ben Lawrence.
Did he just drop, I happen to be in the van with this guy?
Okay, well, you were going to ask the context anyway. No, I was riding the van with a friend who's an industry personality, and, you know, I got a free ride. Anyways, talking to Linsner, and he's like, this is really tough for me. And I'm like, how come? He's like, you got to understand, I spend my entire day isolated from people in my studio, and then I go sit at a table at a convention, and people know my name, they know what I do, they ask me questions that not even my mother ever asks me about my work process. And for introverts who are artists, that's a really unnerving experience, especially if they're not accustomed to it.
That makes sense. Yeah. I mean, we have a local guy who lives down the street who pops in from time to time, and he pays his rent through selling his artwork. So he has to mull out a certain amount of things in order to hit, you know, survival mode.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he's just cooped up in his apartment most of the time.
Sure.
And sometimes it's not fulfilling what kind of art he gets to do, because certain things sell better than more creative things.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. So
yeah, he's a very clever person, but that tends to not sell as well as, you know.
So the comic artist who actually gets to do a project that excites them, inspires them, and leaves them fulfilled, you know, that's a pretty rare opportunity when you think about it.
Very rare. Yeah. I mean, this industry is not easy with them. To get into, and then once you've made it there, it's like, how long are you going to stay there? Plus, is it something that you love?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I know lots of people who fulfilled their dream of being a comic book creator and were outside of 5 years or less. You know, that's like, it was their dreams were kind of broken by the process. They were pretty disappointed.
There's somebody that I know in the industry who has talked about how it's just pretty grueling for her, and it's just like, maybe this isn't what I wanted, you know. Mm-hmm. So
that must be hard to work for something for your whole life, and then just get beaten by.
I can't imagine.
But just like anything that you really, really love, and then you do it as a job, you know, and it's got these deadlines and stuff. Like, you know, I like to make dollhouses, but if I did that for a job, would I like it as much? Because I'd have to hit certain quotas and marks and things, and it makes it more rigid than this like flowing, wonderful creative process.
I mean, they say do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life. But what happens if you stop loving what you do?
Right.
And that's always been a terrifying notion to me. So
the parallel is drawn for me with football players. Mm-hmm. Now, the money aspect is completely different.
Right.
But
these kids work their way up, and the goal is to get into the National Football League and play play pro ball. And of all the college players, I can't remember what the exact number is, but it's like less than 5% of these kids play professional ball. The average like playing lifespan of a professional football player is 3 years.
Mm. Oh, really?
Most of them retire. I mean, if you're 30, you are considered old. Mm. And so...
Well, football is very grueling. It's grueling. It breaks your body.
It's as probably... as physically grueling, if not more so, than like comics creators is mentally grueling. Just coming up with 5 books, 6 books a month, that I can't imagine that kind of output. Mm-hmm. And then you're
working for DC and their editorial, man, that's a nightmare.
And all those crazy jumping jacks. I mean, it's oh.
See, what I would absolutely love is if somebody was writing 6 books for one company and they started missing their own thought line, so all of a sudden you're writing Daredevil and then like the Hulk just walks through a panel. Yeah. It's just kind of like, oh wait.
Well, no. Steve Gerber would do that though. He would have like, you know, you need to get Daredevil in this issue. I'm like, and then, you know, Daredevil and Black Widow will just, you know, swing in and swing out, because he would do goofy like stuff like that all the time. They never had anything. But yeah, he was, I mean, but that guy slipped a groove.
Have you ever like notice a creator just going insane in the pages of their comic?
Oh yeah.
Frank Miller?
Yeah.
Yeah. See, that was one of those questionable, like, is that burnout or insanity or racism or what?
Yeah.
Illness, a little bit addiction, of everything. I don't know. Yeah. Who knows?
I think that's in the case of that gentleman. It's just rampant narcissism. I mean, he's
Frank Miller?
Yeah, he just started believing his own press a long time ago. And,
rampant narcissism does happen in this industry. It's an affliction.
I mean, when you're fulfilling other people's power fantasies as your job, it's kind of hard not to start believing what you're doing is right and everybody is wrong. Am I going off on a tangent?
Well, you know, like George Lucas was surrounded by yes people at a certain point. You see what happened there.
Exceptional point.
Well, and
exceptional
point, Nicole. I can understand an author getting in front. You're going to a Comic-Con. You know, they spend all day by themselves. But then when they go to a Comic-Con, they are rock stars.
Yes. Yeah.
So, yeah, I totally believe it that they
but
drink
your star
their own Kool-Aid.
Can fall. It can fall.
Yeah.
Sometimes quite
and there's
hard.
Some not so ethical things that happen at conventions when there are rampant narcissistic people there. So that's all I'm going to say about that.
Oh, really? You're not going to spill any?
Just...
maybe that'll be a topic for another day.
Questionable things. No, it doesn't need to be a topic. But
the
yeah.
original question is: have
is
you
it like
ever
rock
seen
star
somebody...
writers? So they only have they demand a bowl of green M&Ms.
They're going off.
Okay, right. Sorry.
The original question was: have I ever seen somebody go insane in the book?
Yeah. So actually, there was a book released like this week or last week where it's actually the journal of a man who was homeless and going insane and having like basically it's just like it's a art journal of him basically breaking down, getting into random fights, attacking walls, and
drawn all by the guy.
Yeah, and we may have sold it or may have been a special order, but it but yeah, so literally there are books like that that are journals about people going insane in their real life.
But I think Ben was referring to a creator, particularly in a mainstream book, who like you know,
I mean, like
down.
Steve Gerber, like you know, it's just
I think that he went quietly nuts on a lot of stuff he was doing.
Yeah.
Sorry, the name of that book is, well, it's Love, but spelled with an F instead of an E, so it's Love. And it's The Illustrated Diary of a Man Literally Losing His Mind by Jesse Recklaw. Homeless, penniless, and suffering from bipolar disorder, PTSD, and crippling chronic pain. So, yeah. But, yeah, again, it's a bit different than what we were talking about. But, like, literally, there are books about people going insane during the course of their book.
Wow.
So, yes.
All right. Well...
on that
such
pleasant
a
note.
Lovely topic. All right, let's move on to the next item up for bid. Rapid fire. This is a segment where I ask questions of each of our panelists. Now, I actually gave you all the questions, so you had time to think about the answers. Let's see how much you thought about them. Now, this first question I actually got from the internet. It is a hypothetical. The Death Star blows up the Earth. Who survives?
Is this in a superhero context or just any world context?
Question. Yeah.
Superhero context.
So
Marvel, DC.
don't play that game. Yeah.
So there's a character that I did really like that was introduced, I think by Ed Brubaker called Darwin. He was a lost X-Men character who had the ability to evolve to survive any situation. Uh-huh. And they did a great story once where he walked in front of like the really angry Hulk who came back to destroy the planet. And his powers instantly teleported Darwin to the other side of the planet because they said, you can't fight Hulk. So that would be kind of a thing. He was in the First Class movie and they decided to murder the only black hero they had, who should have been the only one to survive. But that's who I could think survived.
That movie's stupid.
Yeah.
Like, would the Hulk survive in outer space?
He still needs to breathe. He could take a deep breath, but if the planet's gone, he has no real easy way to get to another breathable planet right away.
Because technically he doesn't fly, he jumps.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think he could be like
he's gotta have
shot
a push
off into space, maybe. Yeah.
And he has been.
So,
What about Superman? Can Superman breathe in space?
He can take really deep breaths. And he also has a Phantom Zone projector, so he could have just shot himself into that.
And he is solar powered. However, you know, depending on what era of Superman you're talking about, he would die of loneliness. Maybe not the new 52. I don't give a rip about anybody, and I'm going to tear this parademon's head off.
He just died.
But you know, he would suffer from loneliness. I don't think he would survive.
Okay, outside of superheroes, do you have anybody in any other universes that would survive their planet getting blown up?
There's this guy named Norrin Rad. He rides around on a surfboard.
Dr. Manhattan.
Yeah.
Because he can
just
create. I
think a lot of the nuclear people.
Yeah, the nuclear. Yeah. Solar.
I mean, anybody,
Captain Atom. Yeah. Nuclear.
Depending upon what type of material they have to work with. You know, Swamp Thing could, if he's got some bioorganic material, he could create his own world.
The Invisible Woman, right? She'd be able to because force fields, you think?
She'd run out of air.
Yeah,
but Ant-Man and the Atom and the Wasp could shrink down to the microverse.
That's right.
That's true. Yeah.
Go hang out with Bug and the Croyer and the Space Glider and Baron Karza.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to the next question.
So rapid, huh?
Ben is very, very scared right now.
You brought it up.
What is the biggest misconception regarding a character that can be attributed to the movies?
That Tony Stark is actually likable.
Yeah, that's a good one.
That's a good one.
Yep.
And not a dysfunctional, violent, abusive, alcoholic personality.
I wonder if that was part of Robert Downey Jr.'s contract. He's like, I'll be in these movies and I'll be a bit of a dick, but I don't want to be a complete dick.
Yeah, exactly. I'll be lovable. The lovable jerk.
All right. What would you consider the Citizen Kane of comics?
Oh, wait, we are not done with misconceptions. The biggest misconception for me is that Wolverine is over 5 feet tall. That is what has always stuck in my craw.
So Hugh Jackman is over 5 feet tall, but in the comic books,
he's
not.
Hugh Jackman is six feet tall.
Well, he's like 6'7".
Yeah, no.
In the comics,
Wolverine should be 5 feet or shorter.
Really?
Yes.
All right, that's a good one because
he's an angry little man. There's a reason why I identified with him.
I mean, he's no Puck, but right?
No, he's no Puck. But he is a stout, angry little man, and the casting of Hugh Jackman has always offended me. Always.
Wow.
Yep.
Personal.
I'm so sorry.
I've been trying to work through it. I got issues.
Okay, now can I move on to the next one?
Okay.
All right, what would you consider the Citizen Kane of comic books?
So I had two.
Really?
I had Contract with God by Will Eisner, and I had Black Sad. It's a European import from France, but by two Spanish people. anything by Will Eisner is basically a clinic on how to actually create successful visual storytelling, and also just being able to tell very concise and emotional stories.
Is Will Eisner the namesake of the Eisner Award?
Yes. Yep. There's a whole award system named after the guy. Yeah. So Contract with God is one of the big ones. Mm-hmm.
It's the very first graphic novel ever. Technically, it's the very first graphic novel.
The first credited that way. And it made graphic novels a popular format as well. So Black Sad for me also gets that because the first printing of Black Sad in the States had a quote by Will Eisner saying, oh yeah, that's how you do it.
It's absolutely gorgeous. Yeah. Both the books are just amazingly detailed and cinematic and their flow. And they're funny animal books.
Yeah, well, they're anthropomorphic.
Yeah.
It uses it as a very good literary tool. And because they amplify the personalities of the characters decided on the animals. Like, all the cops are dogs. Stuff like that. You know, the scientist is an owl.
I expect them to be pigs, actually.
But yeah,
you went there. You just went there.
It's one of those where, you know, usually it's either the storytelling or the art, and you don't have a compromise here. It's both.
Yeah.
Both are exceptional and spot on.
Mm-hmm. So those two would be my Citizen Kanes. In a certain aspect, I would say Watchmen, because Alan Moore did have a very cinematic eye in how he broke down the panels. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking for a technical comparison, but as far as like the importance of what the medium could do, I do really like focusing on Will Eisner.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I want to go back to just take a closer look at your question, because when you talk about Citizen Kane, you talk about a piece of work that is groundbreaking, trend-setting, and incredibly
considered like the apex of that specific sort of medium or genre, because everybody says, well, that's the Citizen Kane of cars, you know, or whatever. You know, it's that's what I was looking for here.
No, of course. I just want to clarify that, because to me, you know, I go back and I watch Citizen Kane once every so many years, and I'm still, you know, there are a handful of films that prove the test of time. And there are, and Citizen Kane's getting a little creaky, but I think one of the reasons why it's getting a little creaky is because, you know, we are so familiar with the elements that were precedented in that film, and we forget that's where they came from.
Yeah.
So I am not going to, I don't think I can answer your question, Ben, because I'm frustrated with the state of comic books right now.
Oh, are you?
Because my fallbacks would be books that I'm not so proud of elevating. And that would be Watchmen, The Dark Knight, and Killing Joke. And I've changed my attitude about those books. And I'm actually ready for something new to come along and teach me something new. Because I think it's kind of sad that I haven't been taught anything new since 1986 or 1987. And to keep falling back on those as the great works of literature is really kind of pathetic, and I'd rather not live there anymore, because that's my fallback, you know. And I'm also kind of tired of defending those books as works of literature, because I think the attitude in our culture has shifted.
Have you read Black Sad?
Yeah, you recommended them to me. Remember, I was praising them as you were speaking, and I was trying to keep my mouth shut, which is, you know, it's a tremendous challenge for me.
It's a happier thing to read.
It is. But I was also,
happy,
crime murder.
It's like murder mystery.
Well, it's
and
film noir. It's noir detective.
It's film noir,
but also that's why I started asking about, you know, what is our criteria?
Right,
because I mean, for you, those are great choices. Those are wonderful choices.
Right.
But I was like, you know, that criteria that Chris is using for Citizen Kane of comic books, it's not applicable to me right now, because I'm living in this, you know, biodome of disappointment. So
that is the name of this episode.
That sounds like a great blog name.
That's great.
Okay,
it's up there with Tea Room of Despair.
Yeah.
All right. So let's say someone breaks into your house.
Yeah.
And I had no idea how hard it was to talk and write at the same time.
Oh.
And they force you to sacrifice one of your comics into a placard on your wall. So you have to frame it up in like a GCG or CGC plastic case. You can frame it, you can look at it, but you can never read it anymore. And you're not allowed to buy it again.
Okay. This makes mine even better.
Nice. Did Nicole get to answer the question?
No, yep.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay.
But no, thank you.
All right.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was Black Sad, too. That's about it. So,
So I do have an answer for this next one, but does anybody want to go before me?
Go ahead.
Okay. Strange Adventures number 75. It features a gorilla with a handgun in a library, aiming at the librarian, saying, these three books will allow me to conquer the world.
Yep.
And it's a copy of Treasure Island, Robinson Crusoe, and Moby Dick.
Mm-hmm.
So other than best cover ever, if I could never read it, then the mystery of how do you conquer the world with those three exact books becomes this fantastic, nebulous, imaginary thing.
And you brought this up before, and I don't know if I ever expressed it, but, you know, they have reprinted that particular comic, and that story has been reprinted in collections, and so there have been variations of that particular cover, like three or four times. But I remember buying that on the spinner rack when I was, like, six in St. Helens, Oregon, precisely because of that image of that gorilla holding the books, holding the gun on the librarian, and the word bubble, and I'm like, I have to have this.
It
comic
creates
book.
So many questions yes. that you need to have answered.
Are they answered inside the comic?
They
not
are.
Really.
They were.
Not really. But also, if it's the one that I had, were like four or five different intelligent ape stories from outer space. And so, you know, that cover didn't directly relate to a particular story. I remember because I couldn't read at the time, but I remember my babysitter reading it to me and her puzzling over the word bubbles. Finish your thought, Chris.
No, that was it.
Okay.
Gorilla.
All right. Anybody All right. else? Cole?
Yeah, I think it would probably be Bill Willingham's Elementals number one, which I just love to look at. Bill Willingham in the 80s. I still think he's a terrific storyteller, but he used to be this really unique illustrator. And as an independent creator, he came up with this book that I thought was a superhero book that I thought was so simple in its concept and yet so complex in its execution, which was four human beings who died and came back from the dead as not icons, but
avatars
of the elements. You know, one gal was an aquatic superhero, and she's head green with web fingers. And one guy was called Monolith, and he was represented stone. And one guy was air, and one gal was fire. And I just thought it was beautifully drawn. The villains were cool. The story was cool and a bit kinky. And I love that book. I love that book. It would hurt me to seal it up and not be able to look at it again.
All right, you can look at it. You just can't read it. Nicole, do you have one that you want to place on your wall?
Same thing.
I forgot to look up the issue number. But it's pretty much early Galactus stuff. It's a cover with Galactus kind of standing, doing things.
Is it Fantastic Four?
I think it's Fantastic Four. That's what I think.
Is it a Kirby cover?
It's a Kirby cover.
Is it the introduction of...
Is it the one where he's talking to, like, the Watcher, or...
Is it bigger than a bread box?
It's like 54,
It's been
right?
a while since I looked at it.
Is it early 50s, or is it earlier than that?
I was 54. Thinking it was in the 50s. Sorry, not research. Blah,
That's okay.
blah, blah, blah.
Oh, man, you're dragging down the show, Nicole.
All right, I'm going to move on. I'm going to bypass the last question, save it for another day, and let's move on to Book Report, everybody. And Chris Cassell, let's start with you. What do you want to talk about this week?
So I read the first issue of Cinema Purgatorio.
Oh, yeah.
This was a Kickstarter I'm still unsure if it was Alan Moore who did the Kickstarter or Avatar. I think Avatar did, and why they need
I
to do
watched
a Kickstarter.
The whole video for the Kickstarter, and it was all him.
Okay, so
it's his project.
So it's an anthology book, and it combines, the first sequence, I guess, is always Alan Moore, and it's this really weird, trippy nightmare sequence of somebody going to a theater and the film being some horrible corruption of something they're familiar to see. But then it also includes Code Prue by Garth Ennis, which was a two-issue series that was really charming and horrible, charmingly horrible. And this is the continuation of it. It's the only way to read more Code Prue. Kieran Gillen of The Wicked and Divine has a story called Modded, which is kind of like a horrible Mad Max meets Pokemon thing. There's a More Perfect Union by Max Brooks, the one who did... that zombie
World War Z.
And it looks like that's a story about the Civil War, but with horrible aliens. And then there's The Vast by Christos Gage, which is kind of like a kaiju story. That's all there is to say about that. So they're really quick snippets. It's a $6 volume. Each one of those stories gets like 8 pages or so. It's all black and white. I think that's probably how they kept it down to $6 or so. It's an interesting thing. It's just that there's certain things I just would like to read continually in one sitting. Mm-hmm. So all of the Code Prue, I just want more Code Prue the most. The Vast, which is a kaiju thing, it's a great kaiju thing, so give me more of that. I'm okay with like the Modded story and the More Perfect Union. They're all interesting. I just don't think I like having them broken up this way.
So they're serialized. They're not self-contained stories.
They're continuing.
And the only one that began elsewhere is the Ennis story.
It's the Ennis story.
Do you feel cheated with that?
No, not terribly so.
Read the series.
The interesting thing about Code Prue is it's the one that actually didn't feel cut off. It's like Garth Ennis is the only one, along with Alan Moore, that kind of understood that you can't just stop in the middle of an act. Mm-hmm. Like, he presented a standalone single story within this mm-hmm. 8-page sequence, whereas all the others kind of cut kind of hard for me.
Okay.
Especially the Max Brooks one. It's like, I still don't think he's too used to scripting comics in a certain way.
Zombie books. Yeah. What does he know?
Overall, I did
he
really...
He writes very good zombie books.
He does write good zombie books.
Overall, I did enjoy it. It's worth checking out if you're a fan of most of those names. They're all names that work well together in one sitting. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Well, here's a question for you. Something that has really bothered me about contemporary anthologies, in particular Dark Horse Presents, is... all that serialized information, all that serialized stuff is going to be reproduced in a contained volume down the road.
Probably.
Do you think that's going to happen with this stuff?
I would hope so. Okay. There's more money to be made that way, I think. I do have like a percentage rating system with anthologies, and if you can't beat 50%, I don't like them. So what I mean is like, if there's 10 stories and I only like 5 of them, I don't want to pay for that. Uh-huh. This has a 90% follow through for me, so that is strong for anthologies.
Okay.
The only other books to maintain that percentage for me are the Flight volumes.
Mm-hmm.
Those have like a high 90% for me. So, Dark Horse Presents is like 30-40% average for me. You know. So yeah.
All right, Cinema Purgatorio. Check it out, Cole Hornaday.
Hey,
what do you got for us?
Well, years and years ago, Chris Casso introduced me to this lovely graphic novel. All ages graphic novel called Cursed Pirate Girl. When did that originally come out? Do you remember?
Oh,
many years ago.
And I felt like such an idiot that I had not discovered it sooner. Jeremy Bastain is the writer, illustrator, and the mad genius who does these books. They are timeless. They're fairy tales. It's about the story is really not even worth going into. It's very, very basic. It's this orphan pirate girl, and she's looking for her pirate father. And everybody you meet in these stories is a storyteller. Now, before I get off on too much of a tangent, I'm talking about the Cursed Pirate Girl 2015 annual that came out I think it's October of 2015. This man's artwork is beyond phenomenal. It is Baroque in style and Victorian in sentiment. I had to like practically lift up my glasses and get a magnifying glass to look at all this fine detail work. He has a unique vision of reality that is what Terry Gilliam would like to do if he got more sleep and did fewer drugs. The illustrations in these books, what's that?
Or more.
But Cursed Pirate Girl is with her compadres sailing this fantasy ocean of bizarre creatures and elements, and at every turn someone tells a story, and then someone tells a story within the story, and someone within the story tells a story, and it just sort of spins within itself, but it really doesn't matter because every page is a work of genius, and the artwork is just so phenomenally detailed, and you'll never get tired of looking at it, just at his work, and you can get from beginning to end of this book and then start all over again, and it's going to be entirely new because you're going to see something new and marvelous. So this is technically chapter 4, Jeremy Bastian puts these out maybe
whenever.
Once every other year.
Maybe.
Kind of whenever.
You guys have been reading them, correct?
Yeah. The trick is that there's like a long storied, horrible thing about the first series where like it was small press and then the distributor lost like all the copies of number 2 and they're somewhere next to the Ark of the Covenant inside a warehouse. Mm-hmm. So there's huge gaps of time between every single issue release of this series. My elevator pitch for it is it's Alice in Wonderland meets Pirates of the Caribbean.
But better than both.
Yeah.
You weren't kidding about that artwork either.
Alice in Wonderland aspect, I feel like it's stronger there because, you know, everywhere that Alice went, there's always these different beings and they all spoke and they all had stories and they all
had
different intentions and stuff. And I feel like that pops up in the Cursed Pirate Girl
series. Fairy tales within fairy tales.
Yeah, which I love. I thought that it just adds this magic and enchantment to the world.
I want more people to read this these books because I want to talk with more people about these books. I bought the first one for my niece and nephew. I don't think they even cracked it open. I think they got intimidated by the imagery. So I'm still looking for people to read it so we can talk about it.
It's worth researching. I haven't in the past year or two because that's how long it takes. Mm-hmm. But they were doing a dramedy. They were doing a radio play? Theater.
Yeah, yeah. And Neil Gaiman was involved in it, I thought.
There was a lot of interesting names, including like Chuck Liddell, the UFC wrestler or something like that.
But also into all like, kinds of things.
Grant Morrison was going to be like one of the Swordfish brothers. And I think the actress from Neil Gaiman's Mirror Mask was in it. Uh-huh. But I just don't know if that ever got off the ground.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Cursed Pirate Girl. Check it out so Cole can talk to you about it.
That's right. Please.
All right. Nicole, what do you want to talk to us about?
So I'm going
to
keep it real classy and talk about Grizzly Shark versus Sea Bear.
Oh, heck yeah.
Verily, it's Shakespearean.
Yes. It's by Ryan Ottley. He does the story art and letters, and then colors are by Ivan Placencia, and cover color is FCO Placencia. I don't know. Anyway, it starts off. So this is number 3 in this little mini series, but who cares? It's got a grizzly shark who hunts people in trees, and then there's a bear that lives in the sea that also does things. So it's just ridiculous. It's over the top.
It's exactly what it says it is.
Exactly what you think it
is.
There's
no bait and switch. There are no lies in this comic book.
Just to give you an idea, this third issue starts with a girl texting and updating her Facebook status and a guy tweeting, and they're both looking at each other and driving and tweeting. And the girl goes, driving in the woods. Guy is totally checking me out. So weird. I didn't even put on makeup today. Smiley face. And then his is, by the way, his handle is Kevin is Revin for your bod. And he tweets, girls look so dumb without makeup. Am I right, guys? # stupid girls FML. You can guess what that is. And then they both immediately crash into a rock, shoot out of the cars into the sky.
Yay!
And get munched by grizzly sharks. So that just gives you an idea of what this book is, and it's magical, and it's violent, and it's bloody, and it's funny, and it's kind of cute and endearing, and there's like babies used as bait, but they're it's weird and maybe not for everybody.
Is this Ryan Ottley of Invincible?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
At some point, there's multiple grizzly sharks, and they all end up in the sea where they meet Sea Bear, and then a fight ensues.
Come on, guys. It's kind of like Sci-Fi Channel. Why can't you do as good
so
as this?
It's so much better than Asylum could ever dream of doing. Mm-hmm. And just,
no, let's just do Sharknado 10.
Just come on.
Because that's funny.
I mean, the art style is quirky. I mean, there's a smiling, bloody shark. Driving a boat. I mean, there is, every issue of this is just
pure magic.
Awful and wonderful and just, please.
is it from Image?
It's Image, yeah.
I want diorama toys, so the shark in the woods.
And then in the back, there's a little Scotty Young page that's got a dad and a son. On the son is hanging on his back, and there's a little cutesy shark that's chomping the guy, the little kid. And he's like, really? You babied the grizzly shark? And the guy's like, yeah, that's just lazy. So, even Scotty Young is just like getting in on this thing.
All right, Grizzly Shark versus Sea Bear. Check it out. I'll check that out. All right, well, that's Book Report. That's our show. And coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bomb Podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. You can see everything Nicole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com. And also from the Comics Dungeon right here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford. Or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes or any way you get your podcasts at PerfectBoundPodcast.com. Send us an email, PerfectBoundPodcast@gmail.com, to send us trivia questions, because that's what we're doing now. Quiz time questions from listener John for the second week in a row.
John!
All right, these questions are all tank related.
Oh, no.
Number one. Often the cover feature of G.I. Combat and second only to Sergeant Rock as DC Comics' longest-running war series, this comic book feature appeared in the DC Comics anthology war titled G.I. Combat from 61 through 87. Created by writer and editor Robert K. and
Kanigher?
Yeah. Do you have an answer?
Yeah, it's Haunted Tank.
All right, Haunted Tank. Way to go. Number two. Although it drew heavily from contemporary British pop culture, this comic was initially set in a stylized post-apocalyptic Australia. Cole Hornaday.
Tank Girl!
Number three. This character perished when his fuel tanks exploded in Power Man Volume 1, Number 18, from April 74. That's all you're gonna get.
Wow, that... John, that's just freaking mean, man. I'm gonna... the tank?
Steeplejack or Jake Mallard. All right, number four. This spherical mobile base was used by the evil villain Krang.
Oh, no!
The Technodrome.
Yeah! Number five.
That's where I'm a Viking.
That made you
Welcome
so happy.
To the Technodrome.
Created by Frank Miller, this is the largest vehicle in the Caped Crusaders arsenal, easily able to straddle a three-lane highway. The only thing it can damage, the only thing that can damage it isn't from this planet.
Was it called the Bat Tank?
Bat Tank, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Did they actually
simple.
Call it the Bat Tank? I thought he was still calling it the Batmobile.
According to John E., it was the Bat Tank.
I trust John E. over my recollection.
All right, well, that's quiz time. And that is our show. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week. Woo-hoo.